Hello. This is another in a continuing series of oral history interviews being conducted by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit at Illinois Institute of Technology. This is the 24th day of September, 2019. We're in the Donnelly Room of Galvin Library. I'm Mindy Pugh, the University Archivist at IIT. I'll be co-conducting this interview with Adam Strom, Director of University Archives and Special Collections. Our guest today is Patrick Whitney, Professor Patrick Whitney, former Dean and Director of the Institute of Design at IIT, serving in that capacity from 1985 until 2016. So, thank you.
Happy to be here.
Good. We're going to start off asking you to go back to the beginning and talk about, you know, your early years as much as you would like to talk about your family, your parents. You don't have to get into great detail, but what formed you? What was your career goal? How did that happen? What was your philosophy of learning? And take that up to your arrival at IIT.
Okay. I grew up in Western Canada, in the countryside outside of Edmonton, and had no idea what design was. It wasn't on my radar screen at all. When I was traveling between high school and university, I had my passport taken away at gunpoint trying to cross the border from Nicaragua to Costa Rica, and talked my way across the border and ended up staying with the Canadian consulate while he got my passport back. And he was a filmmaker, and it had never occurred to me before that people made stuff. And as I continued to travel, I bought a camera and started to take photography, enrolled in the University of Alberta's design program, and fell in love with design.
I have to ask, what were you doing in Nicaragua? I assume this is the 1970s. It's a pretty crazy time. Was this during the Somoza regime?
No, it was before that. I don't know what the politics were. We were trying to get our way to South America, hitchhiking, and Central America was on the path.
Okay, all right.
So we were just going through it.
Okay.
And these border guards wanted money, and they finally realized we didn't have any money, so they let us go, but without our passports.
Okay.
So we had a delightful time with Emile Martel, the Vice Consul for Canada for Central America. Played baseball with his son, who ended up being the author of the book Story of Pi, the movie about the tiger. He now lives in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. But I digress. So at the end of my undergraduate degree at the University of Alberta, which was filled with faculty members from England and Switzerland, I realized I didn't know much still and looked for graduate schools, and went to graduate school at the Cranbrook Academy of Art, very small, precious school in the suburbs of Detroit, where Charles Eames and Pretoria and others went. And ended up taking a job after that in Chicago with Robert Vogel, running a congress, an international meeting of societies of graphic design. And that got me interested in the effectiveness of design. We were the first conference to use evaluation methods from psychology to tell whether people were understanding the work that the graphic designers were creating, and made an incredible number of connections, was recruited by the Minneapolis College of Art and Design at the age of 27 to run their design program. And we completely reformed it in 3 years, and I told the president that to be national class or world class, we needed a graduate program. He said, fine, you can do that in 10 years. And I thought, you may work on a 10-year agenda, but I don't. And so I called Dale Fahnstrom, who was running the Institute of Design at that time, and said, if you have a position open, I'm available. I had taught here prior to that as an adjunct faculty member while I was doing the conference in Chicago. And
But you hadn't been an undergraduate here?
No, I didn't study here.
Okay.
I was an undergraduate at the University of Alberta and a graduate student at Cranbrook.
Okay.
Jay Doblin had become the director. He had been director from 55 to 69 and became director again in 82 and has had me come down and be an adjunct faculty member, and I love teaching. I liked it more than the consulting world. So I took the job in Minneapolis, fixed the undergraduate program, left, came back to ID as a faculty member. Dale Fondstrom stepped down after a year, and they asked me to be the director. So that brings us up to my joining IIT.
Okay.
And the school was in really tough times at that time. There were about 30 undergraduate students, 10 graduate students. So we decided to play to our strengths and focus on design methods, which didn't make sense for undergrads, so we closed the undergraduate program and focused on the professional master's degree, which prior to that we had only had a research master's degree. And we went from about 15 inquiries a year to 280 inquiries a year in 1 year. And we grew the master's program from 10 students to 40 full-time students in a three-year period. And we had to, and that's when we decided to close the undergraduate program because we just didn't have enough resources to do both, and the methods education wasn't as appropriate for undergrads as it is for graduate students. At the same time, we created the country's first PhD program funded by the General Electric Foundation. Chuck Owen was the driver of that. And so what we did is flip the population to primarily master's students instead of primarily undergrads, with a small number of PhD students doing research, which makes more sense than master's doing research. So that was it. In 1987, we had recovered enough that we wanted to be more public again, so we recreated the Moholy Nagy auction, not so much to raise the scholarship money, but to reconnect us to Chicago and the cultural community in Chicago. And we did that in 1989 again. And then we moved to developing conferences. We developed a conference called HITS, which stood for Humans, Interaction, Technology, and Strategy, and rebranded that the Institute of Design Strategy Conference and ran that for about 15 years. It was the main conference where business people, executives, would talk about using design, rather than the normal conferences where designers talk about what they do for business. And that was a wild success.
Mm-hmm. A number of the people we've already interviewed, Pat Laughlin, Bruce Sweetser, David Kennedy, Ellen Mitchell, whatnot, were contemporaneous with you in the 1980s, 1990s, when Lou Collins comes in and this overall university is challenged, but from what it seems, there's a lot of empowering of directors to really broaden their operations, make direct connections to business or their constituencies, and create a pipeline and much more direct relationship. It sounds like you already were of that mindset even before you came.
Yes. You know, the world needs better design, and designers weren't great at figuring out what they should do to fulfill that need. And I and the other faculty at ID were good at that, it turned out.
Okay.
So we were successful at venturing out into the outside world and bringing money and attention to the school.
Yeah. Did you work closely, given you've already expressed that you were active in bringing psychology into the mix, did you have a close collaboration with Ellen Mitchell here?
Very friendly collaboration, but not anything that was academic, because their strength is clinical psychology and counseling and human resources, and not the psychology department that we could have worked with had it been here, it would be one that focused on cognitive psychology.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Making things understandable.
Yeah. How helpful or not helpful was the history of ID before you came? How much did you have to take that into consideration, you know, the way that it had been done back to the late 30s?
Well, we celebrated Moholy's experimentation mm-hmm. point of view. We celebrated Sir Chimaev's focus on quality and iconic work, and we focused on Jay Doblin's work on bringing design planning to the fore.
Okay. So
we made use of it. We weren't enslaved by it.
We did what
was relevant to the time.
Sure.
But as an undergraduate, I was focusing on design almost completely, but I did take a sculpture course as a rest from design, and was building a light box. And the faculty member came over and handed me a book saying, here, this will be useful to you. And it was Moholy Nagy's Vision in Motion.
Hmm.
And it was the most important book I read as an undergraduate.
Mm-hmm.
I never dreamed I would be in the school in his position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, he didn't work for IIT, but still being director of ID is.
Right. Yeah,
absolutely. It sounds like you're certainly sufficiently knowledgeable and conversant about the people who came before that probably helped in keeping everyone happy. The downside of a school like that is some people might say there's only one way of doing things.
A few alumni felt that way. Most of the faculty who would have felt that way were gone by the time I got here.
Okay.
So there were some who thought Moholy was the voice of all truth
mm-hmm.
forever.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't anything I had to put up with.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So you were generally at ID in an era when you were empowered to acknowledge the past, but not, I guess you said, not be chained to it. So
yeah. Yeah. What's been consistent throughout the whole time of ID is being at the experimental school.
Mm-hmm.
Willing to throw things out
mm-hmm.
that are good and interesting because you're going to do something new. I once interviewed Mark Goldschall, who was a graduate, was a student when Moholy was here.
Mm-hmm.
And he would talk about coming out of the dark room with a photogram. And they were so excited about talking to the faculty about it, they wouldn't bother to fix it. And they would be talking to the faculty member about it, getting a critique of it, and talking about what to do next as it disappeared. And no one cared.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah, that's cool.
And so speaking of being able to drop things when you felt it was necessary, was the... You were director at the time that the Institute moved downtown, right?
Correct.
Was that I know that part of that was getting you closer to corporate...
Correct.
...Chicago. But did the dropping of the undergraduate program also play a role in that? Because with a master's and PhD program, you're less chained to the campus.
For undergrads, you want a really robust, broad education that involves the students in lots of other departments. I'm not sure we would have done it had we had an undergraduate program.
Yeah, that's an aspect of that move that I never really thought about until just now.
But it put us in closer to the companies for funding purposes. It made it easier for philanthropists to visit us. It made it easier for the students to be connected to the design community to get jobs. It was better in every way.
Whose primary drive was that for? Was it from you or was it from the administration saying you really should look at?
No, it was... I was driving it, and the administration understood why it was healthy for the school. This would be Lou Collins.
Mm-hmm, right.
And everyone made it easy to happen.
Yeah. Is it true that Collins gave you a lot of latitude?
Yeah, he was great.
Okay, all right.
He really cared about quality, and as long as you convinced him you were going to make things better and that it was financially beneficial, he was for it.
Okay. All right. That I've seen one of the publications, there you are, 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
That it was a 15-year lease that was the move back to campus here. I'm sure there's all sorts of arguments or context we need to know about why the move back to campus, but I assume the lease ran out. Was there short-term leases to continue until...
Well, the lease in 350 North LaSalle ran out.
Okay.
But we moved into the downtown campus with the law school and the business school.
Okay.
And the real reason I believe we moved back to the campus is because some trustees wanted us to do that.
Okay.
They thought it would be good for the health of the university for ID.
Okay.
I don't think they did it for ID.
Okay. All right. Okay. Did you feel that was disruptive to some of the connections downtown, or were they sufficiently established that it didn't matter?
No, I don't think that was a problem.
Okay.
I think it distracted us from fundraising for scholarships and research, mm-hmm. which we've been doing a lot of, because all fundraising got steered towards the building.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I didn't raise any money for a couple of years.
Okay.
Because the focus was supposed to be on the building, and it didn't look like the building was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to jump back in time a little bit, when you kind of arrive on the scene at ID and become the director, what did you see as your kind of you raised the graduate population by, you know, a significant amount rather quickly.
Right.
What do you think it was in terms of the trajectory of the school that attracted those folks?
Well, we gave it focus, and we talked about the focus. Before I came, people talked about the design school as a good design school, mm-hmm. and that put us in the realm of other good schools that were saying they were the good design school. What we did is narrowed our focus. We said we were about human-centered design. We were the first school to do that, mm-hmm. use that term. And we're about strategy and design. And that's where we went from 200 inquiries in 1 year to 1,800 the next year. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In a 1 year period, it expanded 8 times. You know, when the world is a noisy, chaotic place, having a clear, singular message helps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it also helps that it's the right message. That was at the time that computer chips were being put inside of products, making them have too many features and being too complicated to use. So the user-centered argument was one that the press and the design community could understand very quickly. And linking it to business was even more innovative, more unusual. Point out why it was in companies' interest to do things that were in consumers' interest. Those are all taken for granted now, and it's the norm, but it wasn't then.
Yeah.
At that time, the most popular way of looking at design was design for manufacturing. Mm-hmm. It was part of the rebirth of the quality movement in America. Mm-hmm. And everyone was comparing American manufacturing to Japanese manufacturing. And Japanese design was tied to manufacturing in Japan, where here it was tied to marketing. So it was in that context that our call for a program in human-centered design and design strategy was, it was the right time for that.
Listening to, you know, you described the schools that evolved under your leadership, much more interest, I can see from, you know, these reports and whatnot, testimony of students who were quite enthusiastic about being able to interact with interdisciplinary agendas, working with business. it sounds like things were really sort of hopping and humming, and you had a lot of people at the table and a lot of people with ideas because you're dealing with big picture sorts of things. Did you find that fun to manage? Or did you find it to be a little bit hard because you've got a lot of precocious people who are knocking on your door all the time?
It was a blast.
It was a blast.
Yeah. Okay. Even when things didn't work, everyone accepted it as an interesting try and try something else.
Okay.
It was great.
I assume you developed the ability, Howard, to say no.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, there
were lots of people who wanted us to would come to us and say, well, you're a great method school if you could only combine it with being a great styling school. Mm. Well, those two things have different cultures and different philosophical points of view. And we were being successful narrowing our point of view, not broadening it.
Okay, all right. But sounds like you never felt you had any challenges to your leadership, though.
Hmm.
Okay.
No.
And I would assume, but correct me if I'm wrong, that your focus on human-centered design placed ID well as design started to get more digital and questions of, you know, the web and...
Yeah, things kept getting more confusing and hard to use, and the worse that was for people out in the world, the better it was for us in the design school dealing with it.
And so was it pretty easy to adjust the curriculum as needed to kind of...
Yeah, the faculty were great at that. They worked hard at it for a year and coming up with a radically different curriculum. At the core of it wasn't drawing and model making. At the core of it was understanding culture and understanding the value creation and understanding how organizations work. We changed the structure of the curriculum where we had a large number of 8-week courses instead of 16-week courses, giving us much more variety and much more academic focus. When you have a smaller class, when you have a big class, and you have to have a designer teaching it, you bring in cognitive human factors and economics in a soft way. When you shrink the class to 8 weeks, you can bring in an economist and a cognitive psychologist to teach those specialties, which is what we did.
Go ahead.
And so you've talked about having the kind of discretion to generally do what you thought was right, and you know you move off campus to be closer to these people that you're bringing in to be able to teach these classes. Did you feel at any point that you, for all intents and purposes, weren't as much a part of the larger university at any point? Or did IIT still loom large?
Sure. IIT was the context in which we worked. And I couldn't do anything without the president approving it. Luckily, Lou and John were very interested in progress and saw the value of letting colleges who had good ideas run with them.
And do you think that the students kind of felt like they were part of the larger university, or...?
No, but they didn't when we were here either.
Okay. Fair enough.
You know, we were... How many years were we in the same building with architecture? And over those 3 years... Over those, it was probably 55. It's probably 40 years in Crown Hall. There were probably 3 projects where we worked with the architects.
Wow.
And we never had visitors from other parts of the university. There was. You know, particularly with the undergraduate program, but with the graduates too, there was such an intensity on the student life in the Institute of Design. It was almost, some of them will say, it was almost a religious experience. Hmm. It changed the way they look at the world. Mm-hmm. And we liked the undergraduate program having 50% of its credits outside of design. That's an extraordinary large number for an undergraduate design program to have 50%. Normally it's 80% of your credits are inside design. So we like that. And the students would have friends outside of ID. But in terms of the project work, it was pretty self-focused on that part of that community. The alumni will still refer to it as a religious experience.
Oh, that's pretty darn good. Pretty
yeah. Darn good. Yeah, the dedication of the faculty and the students is amazing. Mm-hmm. It was very selfless and filled with energy.
And you think that that was, you were able to maintain that as the curriculum and the kind of focus
changed? If anything, it strengthened it because the difference between us and other schools became clearer.
Yeah, it sounds like you're creating a sort of university or universal experience, but without having to, you know, send the students back down to main campus.
IT has lots of strengths, but one of them is not its small size. So its small size keeps there being a broad array of specialties like cognitive psychology or behavioral economics. It's hard to find those specialties in a university this size. So that causes you to turn into the community you're part of, and it causes you to go out to the wider world. So the students did that.
Neither Adam nor I, of course, have been ID students or whatnot, but we've spoken with a lot of people, and I think that sort of religious, as you indicate or as you phrase it, goes back to the beginning in the same level of sort of excitement and devotion with Maholi
One of our strengths is we take people without a design background in high school as undergrads, and we continue that as graduate students. Half of our students don't come with a design background. So that brings in this breadth of knowledge, but it also brings in people who want to be transformed. And so when they find they're in the right place, they do wonderfully well.
This is secondhand testimony, but you knew Jay Doblin very well. We're just curious. We have Doblin's papers, and of course people ask us about him all the time. From what you knew from him or what you knew from alumni or whatnot, again, I'm sort of asking you to kind of fill in ID before your time. What was the excitement under Doblin?
He took over in 1955 when the school was probably at its lowest point. It had been failing as an independent school downtown. Sir Chimaev tried to make a deal with the University of Chicago to take it, but they said no. So he made a deal with IIT, and then he left. And it had a series of part-time directors who, for a variety of reasons, couldn't or didn't do anything to fix it. It was a tough time. So Jay rebuilt it, but he built it. He kept the experimental attitude, but he made it less of an art school. It was really an art-oriented design school under Maholi. Not completely, but to a large extent it would be. If they were doing it now, you'd call it an art school. Under Jay, he focused on it being a professional design school. He was extremely well connected to the leaders of design across the world and around the country. He would bring them here and make the students much more employable at a high level. And he was filled with energy and insight and vision.
So that continues. That's a pretty constant thing the last 60 years now.
Yeah, the school has always been it's a very small school. ID and Cranbrook are more influential than their size would indicate. It's because we're looked to as the likely source of where design is going.
When you took over in 1985, did you think it was going? You were going to spend 31 years here, or
I'm,
were you?
I'm shocked at myself. I never dreamed I would spend that long.
Were you plotting to leave at any point, or just never seemed to be the right time?
No. Working here is a delightful experience because you're making something new and making people's lives better. Mm-hmm. And it kept changing. You know, we moved the school 3 times before moving back to. We moved from the basement of Crown Hall to the tower, and from the tower to 350, and from 350 to the law school. Mm-hmm. We closed programs, opened programs, created executive programs, ran conferences. Mm-hmm. So the job didn't stay the same.
Yeah, yeah. Did you hate leaving 350, or didn't?
No, 350 wasn't. I think it was a mistake to move from downtown.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But there were that was terrible years financially for IIT,
okay.
And it made financial sense to do it.
Okay.
So I understand why the university did. I understand why trustees would think it would be good for the rest of the campus to have ID on the main campus and didn't really care what effect it would have on ID.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They thought it would be neutral. But leaving 350, mm-hmm. it was too many floors, they were too narrow.
Okay.
Do you see the move back to the main campus? Do you think that will have a recruitment effect?
I don't know. Not directly. One way or the other. You mean a negative recruitment effect?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think having the new building will send a message out that the school is happy and alive. I think for foreign students, being on campus is probably more understandable to them than being downtown.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than location. The issue is more than location. It's will the location and the programmatic changes and the faculty changes all together create something that attracts more and better students, or the same, mm-hmm. or less. I don't know. I have no idea. We'll find out.
Well, hopefully, you know, coming down to Bronzeville isn't quite what it was in the 90s from what we've heard from people. So hopefully,
one of our main motivations for moving out of the tower was bullets coming through the window. And because of budget constraints, they only put the bulletproof plexiglass up on the bottom half of the windows, letting bullets come through the top half, bounce around.
Wow. We've heard about that from a number of people, David Baker.
I've got to admit that the bullets through the windows was one of the big motivations for moving off campus. Because, students' lives are at risk.
Yeah. With these bullets laterally coming from
south of the campus projects.
Yeah. Not just from the street.
No. They tended to have an upward trajectory.
Okay.
So probably from the street.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I have to imagine that wasn't conducive to learning and education, especially for a place that is human-centered.
Right.
And you must have had a great, of all the years of quasi-independence you had, the 90s must have been the height of it because other people who are on campus are just trying to save the school here.
Right.
And I can't imagine that they bothered you very much at all.
They didn't.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So in some sense, the saving a main campus and the Galvin's gift, the Galvin Pritzker gifts, and these other things recreate some more living university.
Yeah, the university is infinitely better off now, and better now than it was then. I mean, Lou Collins deserves incredible praise, mm-hmm. I think, for saving the university.
Mm-hmm.
It needed saving at that point. It was not a happy place.
Yeah. You remain in touch with him very much, or?
Not much. We see each other at some events, but life goes on.
Okay, all right, okay. Are you happy being retired, or are you still have the itch to mold your legacy. And
You mean, am I happy having left ID, or am I happy being retired?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, do them separate.
I'm not retired.
Okay.
I have a full professorship at Harvard.
Okay.
Bringing design, as we think of it, to Harvard.
Okay.
Through the public health program, but also related to the Kennedy School and the business school and engineering. So I'm working no less hard now than I was before.
Yeah, my apologies for not knowing what you've been up to the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm having a blast. And I miss the ID community.
Okay.
But I have a new community which is different and pretty good.
Good.
My colleagues are smart people.
Good, good, yeah.
So I have no regrets. I'm having a lot of fun. You know, it's like I miss Chicago because it's not Boston, but Boston is a charming city and a great city in its own right. So we're happy in Boston, but still miss Chicago.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you had to? You know, you said you're bringing what we think of as design to Harvard. Do you feel like you're doing some of the same work you had to do decades ago here in Chicago at ID to kind of change the way people are thinking?
A little bit. Then they thought design was styling. Now people think design is putting post-it notes up on the wall. we can show them how it's a little more than that. So we're working on projects like in Thailand. We're just getting going, we think, on a project to do with developing three new cities outside of Bangkok on the theme of happiness. It's a Buddhist theme. It's a broader view of happiness than the normal one in the West. We're also looking at projects like what happens when medical facilities have no water. And we're looking at problems like why do poor people not take advantage of cooling centers when they have life-threatening heat and die in their homes. And we're looking at the behavioral aspects of traffic accidents on the highway between Mumbai and Pune. It's a high-speed highway, but the main cause of death on it are accidents where fast-moving cars move into the back of trucks going 10 miles per hour. So why are trucks going 10 miles per hour on that highway? We're looking at another new project to do with information pollution. Information is a new pollutant. Not only fake news, but if you look at the web, I'm guessing 90% of it is either old, incomplete, wrong, or lies. So the work that Jaron Lanier is doing on shifting information to be owned by individuals rather than free, which means it's mined by companies, and information that indicates the source of it, who wrote it, rather than anonymous stuff that encourages some of the hate social media messages.
Trying to reconnect information with individual ownership and responsibility to try to civilize, re-civilize.
Yeah, there was an amazing opinion piece in yesterday's electronic version of the New York Times. It's the first opinion piece I've seen which is video instead of writing. And it's Jaron Lanier talking about this new initiative. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
Encourage you to look at it. And Tim Berners-Lee, the guy who invented the internet, created the internet, is working on the second version of it, which deals with this problem of anonymity and people stealing our information about us.
So these all sound like very 21st century issues.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, thinking about the design as a manufacturing kind of industrial design and product design kind of world, as you know, it I think when we all think of mid-century design, we think about
Charles Eames.
Yeah. And
who was a Cranbrook grad.
Yes. And the kind of expansion of not just what things we're designing, you know, we were talking about the web, but this expansion of the idea of what is design and what can design do must have been a really exciting thing to kind of live through for you.
Yeah, it's the core question that drove the Institute of Design while I was here. What is design and how does it make a difference? So, for example, in the Jack Welch world of deterministic product planning, you do a market study and decide who wants the product you're thinking of doing, what are the gaps in the market, and what are the price points, and you decide that and then you optimize towards it. In design, you sense that there's a need out there for something new. You abstract it to what the real need is. So you don't think of it as a car, you think of it as transportation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think of it as a restaurant, you think of it as a social place to eat. And you keep abstracting it and reframing the problem, and late in the process you come up with a different answer than what you expected at the beginning. That type of work can be relevant to all sorts of things right now. Organizations, associations, systems, services, not just physical products.
It sounds like at this point, with all the challenges that the 21st century are generating, which can, on the face of it, be pretty daunting and discouraging, for people to remain motivated and committed to design and to this, they have to have that remaining creativity and that remaining sense that, you know, freedom to identify these problems without being discouraged and without, you know, being too locked in.
Yeah, it's an incredibly optimistic field. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that bumps into all sorts of reasons to be pessimistic.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, the fact that you see it being not just accepted, but grown and fostered in places like Stanford and now Harvard and Yale mm-hmm. is doing something mm-hmm. is a sign of its resilience.
Was there ever anything you wanted to do? I mean, obviously your time at ID was revolutionary for the school in a time for the world of design that was rather revolutionary. Is there anything you wanted to do that you weren't able to do? Were there any big leaps that you wanted to take?
Yeah, I wanted to get a solid funding base for research. And that we brought in a few million dollars in the last years, but that's far from what the world needs mm-hmm. and the faculty could have done. But, you know, there's no National Design Foundation like the National Science Foundation. There's no there's no government money for design. Mm. And so you need to get it from individuals or from companies. Mm-hmm. And that's hard for research in any field. And particularly hard in a field that doesn't have research as part of its normal way of working.
Do you think that would have, had you been able to really, really get that going, would that, it seems to me that could have also almost branched out into these parallel streams of the work being done at ID.
Yes, it could have, and it would also have helped our executive program. Our executive program not only was it very profitable, but it was a way of extending the message to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And that could have grown much larger as well had we had a research component to go with it. Mm-hmm. It's very evident at Harvard how those two things go together.
Mm-hmm.
They have companies calling them, asking them to put together executive programs for them.
Mm-hmm.
They have people coming to say, we want to support your research, what do you need? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very different world.
Yeah, I would imagine dropping into the School of Public Health, kind of a lot of those connections already exist, and it's just a matter of reframing the conversations.
Yeah.
Which it sounds like is something that you spent a lot of time doing at ID, kind of asking, changing the questions you're asking and making sure you're asking the right questions seems to be at the core of
I was with the leader of a design firm in New York and a film production company called Open Box last week. And they're the ones who are doing the new film about Moholy and the new Bauhaus. And he was saying the role he hoped I would take on was developing the new language to talk about the new types of problems we have. He says a lot of people have a sense of what needs to happen, but we don't know how to organize it and and align the different forces in a way that makes a difference. And I can remember doing that with human-centered design and design strategy. I remember the conversation where we decided to call it human-centered design instead of user-centered design. User-centered sounded too druggy at the time. Not commercial, druggy.
And oh, I see.
So we called it human-centered design because we didn't want to sound like we were druggy. But then I started getting calls from the Christian right saying, why are you putting humans at the center of things? Don't you know God is at the center of things?
Wow.
So you lose whichever way you go. But
this theme has been, you've been hitting on it for 10, 15 minutes now. It's like you need a real think tank, or would a think tank not be the way to go to try to
That's in a sense what ID was.
And
is. It's a place that takes problems that aren't being solved in the conventional way and figures out new ways of solving them.
Did the existence of the undergrad program at ID overlap with the iPro program at all? Or did they...
No, I think we'd done away with it by the time iPro came.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Because that seems like a really interesting
overlap. I don't know what's going on with it now, but it took a long time for it to find itself. It started out as a way that they hoped they could raise money, and give students a good experience. And those two things get in the way of each other.
Yes.
They should have made a bigger deal out of it and raised money to support it and make the thing about great student experiences. But they didn't.
Yeah, it sounds like the idea of what the students were meant to be doing in iPro actually would have been...
In some respects, we were doing it.
Yeah. And so it's interesting that these two kind of parallel activities are going on.
And if you look, I don't know what it's like now, but 3 years ago, you look at the effect Jeremy Alexis was having on the iPro program. He was, in a sense, turning it into a sort of design program.
Yes, I understand it. It's in another kind of period of transition at this point.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what it's going to look like when it comes out the other side, but I imagine having ID back on campus is... People are looking towards that as something that will play a role. If only, you know, having that space be used. But we'll see.
It's a noisy space.
It is.
The real test of that space is, are people going to like to work on it? Are they going to, when they are working on their own, are they going to be inclined to come in and work, bump into other people, or are they going to be inclined to stay home and be away from the noise? Windowless floor.
Sometimes when I'm on the lower level of Crown, I think about those days of ID being there.
Right.
And I think, boy, what a kind of dark and dreary place to have your entire existence play out. But at the same time, there's less distraction.
It was a preferred space because it was cooler. Crown Hall for decades was a black glass box sitting in no shade with the sun beaming into it. It was a greenhouse. And it was cooler downstairs.
I hadn't thought about that. And you had the restrooms.
Yes.
What brings you back to Chicago?
I came in for the screening of the introduction of the new film about Moholy Thursday night.
Okay.
And did a... moderated conversation with Dirk Lohan about Mies and Moholy in our apartment in Lakeshore 880 Lakeshore Drive. And taking care of other things that are taken care of a little bit too late now that we moved to Boston.
Okay, all right. Do you have family? I'm sure you have tons of friends and associates. But
I have no family here. Okay. My family's in Canada. Okay. But we have lots of friends here. We love Chicago. Mm-hmm. All
right. So looking back on your time at ID, you know, there's obviously a lot. You know, we could create a bullet point list of all the things that you did and influenced, and we wouldn't have time to do it today. But is there anything you're particularly proud of that doesn't necessarily get talked about, or anything that you, when you look back, you think, oh, that's a thing that I would like people to remember about my time there?
I think ID led the way in the formalization of design knowledge, along with a small number of other schools like TU Delft in the Netherlands and maybe KAIST in Korea. Mm-hmm. But very, very few other schools worked on formalizing the methods. And it's the lack of formalization in the methods is one of the main things that keeps design back from being more influential. It's hard for people in other fields to work with designers because they don't know why we don't go and do the damn job and design the thing the way that they describe it. You know, but we've had tremendous influence in that. In the late 70s and 80s, there was this idea of a design brief, a description of a project that would come from a client, and it was your job to be creative and design something within the boundaries of that brief. Mm-hmm. Now, and if you ignored the brief, you'd be fired as a consultant. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't call it ignoring the brief, we call it reframing. Mm-hmm. And that's where most of the fees, high fees are now for doing what we used to call ignoring the brief. Mm-hmm. It's helping companies and organizations see what the future can be and how it can be better than what they imagine.
Okay.
Is what we do. And keeping or helping the school and the faculty organize a way of doing that in a more orderly and programmatic way is, I think, one of the main contributions. We also brought back its recognition.
Mm-hmm.
It had been a forgotten school,
mm-hmm.
known only for its history.
Mm-hmm.
When I came in, it took 3 or 4 years before we were known again.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you kind of, in re-envisioning the school and what it could be, you were at the fore of creating another era that people now look back, it seems, look back fondly on as like, oh, that was a real, that was another really fertile time for ID. You know, and it sounds like as ID, you know, as the student body dropped a little bit and things moved back down to campus and people felt like, well, we're not quite sure where things are going at this point, that your era has kind of become a second era of real pride for the school.
Yeah, I don't know how the enrollment is doing now. Do you know how it's doing this?
No. I was referring back to those years that, you know, all of a sudden you had too much space and we're heading to Kent. And I remember at that time hearing that enrollment had dipped a bit, as it had around
the enrollment has gone up and down for a variety of reasons. And most often we don't know what the reasons were.
Yeah.
It's such a small number of students coming into ID that it's hard to talk about trends.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, in a model where enrollment is everything, you're pretty much just guaranteeing yourselves the peaks and the valleys. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Right. That's true. Before the move downtown, were there ever any recommendations to go out to West Campus, or West Campus was all the thing in the late 1980s.
Right. Are we glad we didn't move?
Okay.
No, that was never mentioned.
Okay. All right, good. All right, so there was a pressure.
There weren't ideas so small, and engineering captured so much of the attention of IIT that I think that our independence was often caused by us being forgotten.
There's a virtue in that.
Yes, there is.
You plan on staying in harness for unforeseeable years yet?
As long as I have fun.
All right. Well, that's good. So as far as all of us can tell, retirement's pretty problematic. Pretty problematic, not just financially, but also, you know, you spend a life working and building connections, and so it's good to, you don't regret your previous employer if you've moved on to the next one.
Right.
So.
Right. No, I'm a happy guy. Harvard is very different, very unusual, so it's every day brings new excitement there.
Good. Very good.
Well, as we kind of work our way towards a close here, is there anything we haven't asked you about that you wanted to speak about?
No, I don't think so. I think you've done a good job of covering it.
Okay, yeah, great.
Excellent. If I think of something big, I'll let you know. We can do it again.
Okay.
We'll be here.
We will,
thank you for your good questions and the invitation.
Well, and thank you for taking part.